Armand, I am very confused. When we talked about Rebel Moon Part 1 earlier this year, I thought it was okay. I didn't think it quite deserved quite the harsh criticism it was getting from a lot of the internet. I know you were a defender of that film in your National Review piece. I believe you called it Star Wars for Grownups. And in our conversation, you had mentioned that Star Wars doesn't have any kind of resonance for you at all. So I think that's sort of high praise that you could derive some kind of, a fantastical space opera element from this piece of entertainment that finally resonated with you, which was cool. Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scar Giver, just came out, and you had a decidedly different, I think, reaction to it. In your piece for your new piece for the National Review, you refer to it as the trailer for Netflix's Rebel Moon, the film itself being the trailer because, in your estimation, because Zack Snyder is not releasing the full director's cut until sometime at the end of summer, that it's impossible to evaluate this movie and even Rebel Moon Part 1 on their own terms. So how are we going to talk about this movie today? And did you understand the whole director's cut thing? Were you aware of that before you went into the film, or is that something you learned after? I guess I'm trying to figure out, were you open to watching Part 2, or was it afterwards you realized, oh, I didn't actually watch a full movie?
Well, maybe I should start with an explanation of my method. I try to go to a movie knowing nothing about it, except who made it, perhaps. I don't read pre-release articles about movies. My interest in cinema doesn't work that way. I wait to see the film when it is presented to me. So I, unlike a lot of people, I guess, was simply unaware of Zack Snyder's method now that he's working at Netflix. I was not aware that he had this process in mind whereby he would release PG-rated versions of movies and then wait, I guess, until enough money was made to finally release his full version, a version which, as he said on his Joe Rogan podcast, fulfilled his vision, fulfilled his ambition for these movies. I was unaware of that. So last fall, when I saw Rebel Moon Part 1, Child of Fire, I thought I was seeing a complete movie, and I tried to read it as best I could, and I found much to commend in it. And that was the way I watched Part 2, Scar Giver. Then I heard from friends that Zack Snyder had plans to release a director's cut. And I took that to just be foolishness a kind of foolishness that's popular these days, releasing director's cuts. I didn't take it seriously until I came across the Joe Rogan podcast, where Snyder fully explained his intentions. And his intentions were that he was conceding to Netflix and making a family ready PG rated film, but that his true vision, his hardest vision, later in the year. And I thought, wait a minute, I've been tricked here. This is some sort of bait and switch that's been happening here, and this is not the way I like my artists to behave. I said I don't like to read about movies before they come out, but I do read a bit about movies after they come out. And this was not the history that I have saluted and esteemed and was proud of in the filmographies of directors like Orson Welles and Robert Altman and Sam Peckinpah and Sergei Eisenstein. They didn't hold back. They released one movie per movie. And they struggled to get that one movie made. They struggled to get that one movie presented before the public. Zack Snyder's not doing it. And I realized that I don't like that. I don't like his method that he's chosen. But also I felt, that explains what I felt was wrong with Scar Giver. That explains why I felt that throughout the movie there were so many plot holes, maybe perhaps, or just unexplained behavior. What looked like curtailed sequences, what looked like interruptions or ellipses in the narrative. I thought that must be why Scar Giver was so dissatisfying or unsatisfying to me, because it's not the full movie, and I need to wait for it.
couple of things. Are you going to be able to put these feelings aside in a few months to watch the, I guess, the 6-hour magnum opus? Because he's going to do a director's cut of part one and two, from what I understand. Or, I mean, are you going to kind of boycott them? Or are you just, yeah, are you going to memory hole these versions until you see the complete version? How do you anticipate that affecting your enjoyment of the film? Because this is like the ultimate version of almost being forced to learn about the movie before you see it. It's kind of a cheat. Not on your part. I'm just saying, your framing, Zack Snyder putting out this version as a tease before the real version comes out, it seems like it could be very confusing in terms of artistic appreciation.
Well, listen, I think Snyder is a wonderfully gifted filmmaker, and so I'm anxious to see his full vision, what he has called his full vision. Not me calling it a full vision. He told Joe Rogan the upcoming film is his full vision. And I'm still interested in seeing that. And this disappointment in his method, and I have been disappointed with him for some more serious and political reasons, but that won't get in the way of appreciating what he puts on screen when it's his full vision. I'm waiting for the real movie to come out. You might be interested to know, it's a side story. Way back in 1990, I saw Francis Coppola's Godfather Part III, which I think is a very great movie, a film I love. And then afterwards, I saw the trailer after I saw the movie. And there's a magnificent moment in Godfather Part III where a bishop is assassinated. And mm-hmm. he's thrown down a staircase, and his body hurtles towards the camera. Just a magnificent moment. And when I saw the trailer, I thought, wow, if I had seen this in the trailer, I would never have been able to appreciate it in the movie. I went back to watching trailers as movies became worse in the aughts. Because I thought, what difference does it make? Most movies are terrible these days, so you might as well watch the trailer. All right, I go back to watching trailers, and then all of a sudden, then eventually Zack Snyder presents me with two trailers. I consider that a kind of betrayal of someone who watches movies as works of art. So I am obligated now. I'm obligated now to put it together if I ever see the full versions, just to appreciate them as they are. All he could have spoiled was a certain kind of visual discovery for some sequences. But frankly, I don't know what he has in mind for Rebel Moon 1 or 2, because none of us have seen his full vision.
I'm curious, because I understand where you're coming from. I did also notice some odd developments in the course of watching part 2, more so than in part 1, where it definitely felt like there were elements missing. But I kind of breezed over them because I think I was keyed into the emotions and the visuals of what the movie was trying to tell me. So in that sense, I was kind of enraptured. I really enjoyed this movie. But I want to ask you how you feel about what Peter Jackson did with Lord of the Rings trilogy, because he released those theatrically. And it wasn't until some time later that he started coming out with these director's cuts that came out on home video. And eventually, I think those were shown in theaters. But in my estimation, I hated the Lord of the Rings films when they first came out. It wasn't until I saw them fleshed out as these, you know, extended director's cuts that I really appreciated what Jackson was doing with that text. So is this a different case simply because Snyder is sort of announcing, hey, watch this. Oops, fooled you. It's not what you're supposed to be watching. Or is there something else going on?
I'm afraid it's probably a very similar case, yet a different case, because with Zack Snyder, we're dealing with a great filmmaker, a possibly great filmmaker, and a real artist, not the case of Peter Jackson. I could care less about what Peter Jackson adds to the Lord of the Rings movies. He stole 9 hours of my life. He doesn't get any more with that venture.
Let me ask, though. I not to cut you off. Have you watched the extended versions of Lord of the Rings, or did you stop at theatrical?
I gave him 9 hours. He gets no more with that topic, with that subject. That's it. He's done. he's had as much time, Lord of the Rings time, as I am going to give him. That's it. Because I didn't think they were any good in the first place. So I certainly didn't want to see any more of them. Whereas with Rebel Moon Part One, now that I realized the trick has been played on me, I'm still interested because it was good. I see more, and I'm curious to see more. So that puts Zack Snyder in a position that Peter Jackson is not in for me. So it's similar because, and it's similar in a sad way, because it says to me that, it says to me that Zack Snyder is falling into the kind of commercial hackdom that Peter Jackson occupies. And I'm sorry to see that happen to someone as talented and interesting as Zack Snyder is. But that's who he is. That's what we're faced with. There's a hack side to him, which I kind of, in my piece, National Review piece, I refer to that moment when Ridley Scott announced to the world that I am not an artist, I am a hack. And that was kind of devastating when that occurred. So Zack Snyder's found another way to tell us that I'm an artist, but there's a whole lot of hack in me, and I'll do whatever the studios want because I don't believe in this art form the way Orson Welles and Sergei Eisenstein did. I'm sorry about that, but just have to deal with it.
You know, there are some that would argue that Snyder showed his hackdom a while ago. I would say it goes at least back as far as Army of the Dead, the thing he did before Rebel Moon. But I want to just step back for a second and say, I understand where you're coming from with Lord of the Rings, and I don't know there's anything I can do to convince you, but I carried around that same sentiment for 12, 13 years, saw the trilogy in the theater, didn't get anything out of it really. And friends told me, you have to watch the director's cuts. It makes everything more coherent. It makes it, frankly, each one a better film. And I asked the same question. Why would I watch more of something that I hate? When the Hobbit films came out, I went back and I did the homework and I watched Lord of the Rings. I finally got it. They do flow better. And I just think they're overall stronger movies. I'm just saying. Now, as far in the case of Peter Jackson, also, I watched for another podcast his King Kong remake from 2005. And that's the thing that scares me about watching a longer cut of Rebel Moon, because aside from what I think are minor details in part two that could be solved with a couple of lines of dialogue each, when I watch something like King Kong, you look at the 1933 version and it's fast, it's breezy, it's pretty much note perfect. When we see Ann Darrow stealing the apple from the street vendor, and the director comes up and saves her from a life of crime and turns her into a movie star, that's all we need to know. Peter Jackson took an hour to tell us how Ann Darrow got to that damn fruit stand, and that's something I couldn't care less about. So I'm hoping Snyder avoids those pitfalls. But when we talked about Rebel Moon, I ended it by saying, hey, he announced that there is a director's cut coming out. Now, he hadn't elaborated on this whole kind of director's cut scheme, and then that's how he was treating both movies at the time. And I asked you about, how you would feel about if watching a director's cut would affect possibly your estimation of the movie. And you said at that point, I don't need to see a director's cut. Rebel Moon Part One is, the movie that I appreciate and I really enjoy. So now when you go back and watch both versions, I assume, now knowing what you know now about how the sausage is made, is there any chance that could taint your enjoyment of it, even if you're like, oh, this makes a bit more sense now, I still feel like I've been manipulated?
Well, listen, I won't give Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings another chance. I just won't. Because what I saw the first time, I thought was rotten.
Rotten.
I'll give Zack Snyder a second chance. I, under the impression that Rebel Moon Part One was all I was going to get, I was content with that. I'll take it. If he's got more to come, I'll watch that the same way I watch Francis Ford Coppola's recuts of The Godfather, of Apocalypse Now, just because I respect him as an artist and am curious to see what he does with it. Sure, I'll watch the fulfilled Zack Snyder cuts of Rebel Moon. They won't get in the way of my appreciation, but my hope now is that part one will be improved, even though I thought it was good as it was, and that part two will also be improved. He earns a second chance, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I felt the same way because I felt like I had to work really hard to like part one, because as we discussed, and you know, I'm a Star Wars kid, all I could see were the references to, you know, him kind of doing his version of what George Lucas was doing in part one. I understand that that's not exactly fair, but I couldn't quite shake it. Watching part two, I was much more, I think it's because we'd established the characters. They didn't have to do all this, you know, similar running around. But what I did see was Star Wars again, but consciously or unconsciously, I felt that in this 2 hours that we just watched, what Snyder did was he remade the sequel trilogy from Star Wars, like all three films, compacted them into one pretty sharp narrative, and I think delivered the movies that J.J. Abrams and Rian Johnson kind of failed to deliver, something that spoke a familiar kind of film and narrative language, but also had panache, had balls. I mean, Ed Skrein's Commander Noble character is what Adam Driver should have been doing with Kylo Ren from the beginning. In fact, he should have been the villain in that trilogy. I thought it was pretty amazing. I think, you know, Sophia Boutella as Cora was the heroine that the Star Wars sequels, if they were going to bother making them, which in retrospect, I don't think they should have, really deserved. She was strong. She was damaged. She was a fighter. I mean, it was a messy dynamic, and I am kind of curious to see what more they flesh out with the extended cut of part two. But I think what we got in part two was pretty terrific.
Well, I told you so. I told you so in part one. You know, when folks complain that part one and even part two are derivative, it tells me that they don't know what myth is. They don't know what culture is. You know, there are no original narratives. It's just a way of people trying to pretend that they are sharper, that they are smarter than the filmmaker. And I think they're up against it, a very gifted artist like Zack Snyder, and they're wrong about it. They, you know, give him a chance to express himself, give him a chance to respond to Star Wars, give him a chance to respond to all the other movies and art influences that he has experienced. Don't try to be smarter than him, because he's not Peter Jackson. He has extraordinary cinematic gifts, cinematic talents. Extraordinary, as you know, as so many scenes in Rebel Moon Part One demonstrated, such as the beautiful shot of the sequence of the Griffin being tamed and flying, or the beautiful sequence where Nemesis, the mother figure, fights with the arachnid female. How Zack Snyder in that sequence in particular responds even to Alien is extraordinary. Give Zack Snyder a chance to respond to his cultural experience and bring so many of those experiences together, not just Star Wars, but Alien as well, and other films and other cultural resources that he has in mind. I think he needs to have more faith in that rather than succumbing to the Netflix commercial machinery.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because I don't know if that was part of the deal that he had to cut with Netflix, if that was his idea, if it was a studio mandate, like, we'll give you this money if, because, you know, Zack Snyder has a hit or miss track record at the box office. So it might just been a matter of, like, they were the ones who would give him a deal to make the movie that he wanted, but it came with these certain kind of handcuffs. I mean,
That's not what he said. He didn't say that. He didn't say he had
handcuffs. I didn't watch the Joe Rogan interview. I haven't caught up with it yet. Well, so
it's worth listening to, because this is a circumstance that he explains. He likes this arrangement with Netflix. He agreed to it. That's the problem I have with it. My thought is that millionaire artists don't do that. millionaire, as an artist, when you got the money, money gives you freedom. And that freedom should, especially in the case of a streaming service like Netflix, any proven artist that they sign with should have carte blanche, more or less, within reason. And if after his fabled or controversial problems with Warner Brothers, if he didn't get that when signing to Netflix, what's the point of signing to Netflix? Yeah, you might as well be an indie and struggle on your own. But anyway, that's who he is. And now, but we as viewers shouldn't fall into the trap of accepting this, I think, terrible compromise of not holding true to your vision of an artist not holding true to.
I agree to a certain extent, because there's two things that you said there that I think are key. One, he agreed to it. Now, I don't know if that was he was shopping around for someone to give him the money to make his film, and Netflix said, hey, we'd like to do this with you, but here's how we'd like to do it. And he agreed to that, or if it was his idea and they struck an agreement. I don't know. I wasn't in the room. But as far as the millionaire artist, yes, that's true. He's had a very successful career for, you know, well over 20 years now. But there's a difference between that being wealthy and having, let's just say, $250 million, $500 million to make a film. I don't think Zack Snyder has that. He certainly wouldn't have it to gamble, whereas Netflix or any other major studio would have that. So it could be if he, and he had shopped this idea, from what I understand, around as a script for a Star Wars movie, and it was rejected by Kathleen Kennedy or Lucasfilm or whoever. So if it came to, all right, I really want to make this movie, it's a passion project, who's going to help me, you know, make it? I mean, he could probably crowdfund or something, but I don't think he's going to get closer to his vision through that. So I agree it'd be better to sit and wait and watch for the definitive version of both of these films. But if the compromise is, we will let you make your movie, here's the money, but ... I understand the artistic compromise there. I don't think that takes away from his, you know, creativity or, you know, his legitimacy as an artist. It is kind of disappointing that he was put in that position in the first place, I think.
I only find it disappointing that he agreed to it. Listen, we have the great example of Francis Ford Coppola, who time and again, we are told, mortgages his home to make the movies he believes in. You cannot have a more valiant example than that. Why not follow that example? I mean, I can't tell anybody what to do with their personal finances, but, sure. But there's a beautiful example in what Coppola does. Why not follow it?
Go ahead.
I think it's an important point to make, given the state of the culture. Why go along with a system of movie making and movie financing that disrespects the audience, that thinks the audience is not ready for sexual material, that isn't ready for material that explores the violent side of human nature? Why give into that? If you are an artist and you know better, go for it, or else leave it to the hacks, leave it to Peter Jackson, who makes a mess of Tolkien. Who makes an insulting, a disturbing mess of Tolkien's spiritual and religious message. Leave movies to the hacks then. Or, you know, I mean, go all the way with hackdom, Mr. Snyder. Be one or the other. Don't mess it up. Because what he does then is that he accustoms the public to being disrespected by Hollywood and the studio system.
I think there's got to be a compromise there, because I agree. I think Francis Ford Coppola mortgaging his house is a noble thing, but Francis Ford Coppola so far has not made a $250 million sci-fi epic. He can mortgage his house for whatever money that will get him to make the kind of movies he wants to make. If he wants to make Godfather 4, he could probably afford that. Now with Zack Snyder, I think there might be a compromise ground there that would make both of us happy, which is to find the scrappy young talents. I mean, look at the folks behind Godzilla Minus One, a film, granted, I have not seen yet, but it won the Academy Award for Special Effects, going up against the $250 million, $500 million big studio movies. You got a team of guys knocking this stuff out in, you know, a year or whatever it was for a fraction of the cost that it took to make those movies. I think if Zack Snyder can find that crew and, you know, find the stable of actors that are, you know, willing to work for points or something like that, so he saves on the front end, I think there could be a real solution there. Can you make a movie that looks as amazing as Rebel Moon, that feels like Rebel Moon, that realizes that vision for a fraction of a fraction of the cost? I don't know, but it would be interesting to see Zack Snyder try.
I never discuss budgets and money. First of all, because I'm not interested in it. Second of all, I don't know about it. I don't know about the financing or costs of film production. In my mind, every movie costs the price of my ticket. At one point I could say the budget for any movie is $10, as far as I know. And that's all I care about. I don't care about how much money a movie costs or how much money was saved. I don't care about that. I care about the result, the end product. So if Zack Snyder can make a great looking movie for $50,000, like Bertolucci's The Spider Stratagem, that's all he needs to do. And since he's gone so far as to become his own cinematographer, whether that means cost cutting or whether that means he doesn't trust anyone else's contributions to his work, that's fine. Make the movie that you have envisioned. Do that. Don't compromise on the vision. I mean, we're talking about art here. We're not talking about popcorn. We're talking about art here. Don't compromise your vision. There is no don't compromise your vision. That's all. And because I guess I have to repeat this, the culture, as culture has been ruined, and audiences are used to compromises, but they're only used to compromises because they don't value what real art means. And I still know what it means. and I was educated to know what it means. So that's the standard I'm always trying to hold to. And I hold good artists to those standards as well. No compromise. Make your movie.
Well,
make the movie you have in mind or don't.
But I mean, here's the thing, right? I'm not saying you need to consider the budget or know the budget or any of that. But the reality of making films is that they do cost a lot of money. Now, could Zack Snyder, again, make Rebel Moon with the resources that he has? It's entirely possible. It might be, you know, different, but if you want to make a galaxy spanning sci-fi epic adventure in two parts or six, I don't know, because as we found at the end of Rebel Moon Part Two, it's not the end, it's, you know, part two of whatever, then the reality is, if Zack Snyder just made it with the money that he has, I don't know that we would have seen that.
And don't worry about the money. Don't worry about the money. The money isn't significant.
It's not insignificant, because
you're not in control of the bank book, and neither am I. An artist said, well, we're thinking about it in separate ways then. Because an artist, whatever the budget, you do the best you can, but don't fool the public. That's dishonest. That's a betrayal,
I think.
I agree.
Don't do that. But
make the best movie you can. If it costs 10 cents or $10 billion, make the best movie you can. Don't compromise on it. Because the compromise then becomes, it then not just becomes an artistic compromise, it becomes a moral compromise. Because then you're willing to cheat the public, as has happened in the case of Rebel Moon. So you pushed me that far. That's what happens eventually. You wind up cheating your audience, disrespecting your audience. Do that.
I think we are thinking along similar lines here, because I think the solution to this problem, such as it is if Zack Snyder had just kept his mouth shut about the deal, I don't think we'd be having this conversation. Because let's just take the Lord of the Rings example, going back to your favorite film trilogy. Peter Jackson began releasing those movies, and I think it was later when they started hitting the home video market that they announced that there are extended editions. He didn't come out in 2000 or 2001, whenever these movies came out, and said, here's this amazing theatrical experience. By the way, you're not going to see the real one for another couple of years. I think if Zack Snyder had teased at the end of part one, oh, there's going to be a director's cut later, And possibly the same for part two. Audiences are used to that kind of thing. We've been seeing that since, you know, the DVD era or earlier in the 90s. But I think this coming out and talking about the business of it is sort of corrupting the desire, the suspension of disbelief that, like you're saying, we pay $10 to go see movie magic. Right now, he's telling us about the deals that were made and that we're watching a compromised piece of art that we're not going to be able to truly fully appreciate for another, what, 3-4 months. So yeah, make the movie. I think if Snyder wanted to make this movie on his own, he could have. It would have been a different picture, because again, these movies cost what they cost. He could have explored avenues to make it, you know, on a budget that is not $250 million. I think that would have been really interesting. Maybe he'll try that for his next picture. Well, no, probably not, because like James Cameron, he seems to be wrapped up in this own cinematic universe, and I don't know when he's going to get, you know, off the planet Velt, but I guess we'll see.
All right, listen, I don't mean to be a dick, but I never say movie magic. I never say that. But I do believe in movie miracles, though, and miracles can happen when things go right for an artist. And that's, I mean, there were miracles in Man of Steel, throughout Man of Steel, in fact. And Zack Snyder can do it. He can put himself in a position where his art seems miraculous. That's what he needs to do. He's revealed himself to be more commercially minded than perhaps he needs to be. I understand that Hollywood is a business, and every artist has to contend with the rules of that business. But also all the great film artists that we care about, like Orson Welles, like Eisenstein. Well, Eisenstein's worked for the Soviets, but Joseph von Sternberg and others, they found ways to become artists within the structures of those businesses, and to make one film, one movie per movie, as I think of it now. That's enough. If artists like Coppola wants to tinker and make other recuts later, that's his business. Just like Spielberg recutting Close Encounters, but not making it better, just tinkering with it and wasting time, frankly. Artists shouldn't do that. Move on to another project, and whatever you feel you didn't do right the first time, get it right the next time. That's what artists do. Artists are never fully satisfied. That's why some make more than one works of art. They keep trying to get something perfected. Zack Snyder can do that, but you don't cheat the public the way he has happened here. I can be patient. I will give no more time to Peter Jackson, but I can wait on a full Zack Snyder movie.
I think there's a key distinction there with what you said. In the case of, you know, Coppola or Spielberg going back to their work, that is, or even George Lucas, with agree with what he did or not with the Star Wars films, facing the limitations that he had back in the 1970s versus what he could do in the late 1990s with more fully realizing things with digital characters, digital backgrounds, going through and making a different version of that film. That's one thing. What Snyder has done here is, as I think you astutely observed, is he made a 2-hour plus trailer for a movie that we have not yet to see. And the more I'm talking to you about this, the more irked I am getting, because as I mentioned, I did enjoy Rebel Moon Part 2, but I'm like, yeah, but did I even really watch it? I think the answer is no. So what I'd like to propose, because this was ostensibly going to be a Rebel Moon Part 2 review, but it's talking about why we haven't seen it yet, or even Part 1 for that matter. If you will agree to it, sir, I'd like to come back to this in a few months and talk about Rebel Moon Part 1 and 2 when we actually get a chance to see them.
I think that would be worth doing. I trust that it would be worth doing. I'm sure Zack Snyder has things in mind that he wants the public to see. So I'm still curious to see them. I was also disappointed at part two of Scargiver when it became clear, oh, oy vey, this is not the end. There's more. Good Lord, you know, and enough already, in a way. How long is he going to carry this story on? But But see, I kind of consider that to be another commercial compromise. Make your movie, tell your story, move on to the next project. God, I would love to see him do the Fountainhead. But anyway, he should complete this movie and move on.
Yeah, I agree. It's a very strange position to be in. I will say one last thing. The thing that I did observe, and I wonder if this is going to be, if I'm going to feel the same way once I see the complete films. It's as if, you know, there's been a lot of talk about AI and, you know, artificial intelligence, especially when it comes to movie making. And I don't know if you feel the same way about that as you do, like, budgets. Like, that's kind of ancillary to what the final product is. But I was thinking about AI a lot watching Rebel Moon Part 2, because the components of AI from an artistic standpoint is, even if it's generative, it's not original. It's based on everything that has been assembled from this massive global database of information over, you know, the last several decades, right? So if you ask it to generate an image, it is generating an image based on prompts, based on composites of other images, even though it kind of quote unquote looks new. I felt that same way watching his kind of Star Wars homages. As I mentioned, I think he improved upon a lot, but the difference here in Rebel Moon Part 2, from what I can tell so far, is he used that AI sensibility as a tool. Here's a lot of stuff you're familiar with. Here are some archetypes. Here are even some visual cues that you may be familiar with. The one character, I cannot remember her name, Milius. She's the one soldier who has the black kind of stripe over her eyes. She looks like Charlize Theron in the new Mad Max movies, or I guess Anya Taylor-Joy now. I felt like he took the iconography of that character and wanted to play with her in his own universe, but he can't because that's owned by another property. But he made this character his own, as he did with even swiping from himself, James, the robot, voiced by Anthony Hopkins. If you look at even some of the shots of him stalking the camp, watching the farmers, I guess, from the hilltops, and you notice he's got this kind of a flowing, tattered red cape. That's the exact image of Ephialtes from Zack Snyder's own 300 from 20 years ago, the outcast watching from afar with the tattered kind of warrior's remnant outfits. So there's a lot of cool stuff in here that is sort of remixed AI art style, but not something that's just thrown out there to say, hey, remember this, remember this. He's tweaking kind of our expectations, at least visually, I think.
Well, it's nicely put, and it certainly puts paid to those who complain that the movie is derivative. You know, that's just a stupid comment to make about Zack Snyder. Sure, the resonances of other movies is fascinating. And it's those kind of resonances that tell us that we are dealing with an artist and we're watching a work of art, which AI will never replicate. I recall in Ayn Rand's famous West Point commencement address, she sort of predicts the future of AI, the coming of AI, of artificial intelligence. And she talks about how people rely on computers, and she uses that great common person phrase, garbage in, garbage out, that a computer can only give you what has been put into it. And the difference between AI and art and an artist and art is enormous. And it's all based on, I think, the idiosyncrasies of creativity, the kind of idiosyncrasies that a machine can't give you, that a logic-based machine cannot give you, but that a human being can. So that when Zack Snyder repeats images from his own movies or other people's movies, not only does he improve George Miller's Fury Road, was that the name of it?
Yeah.
Not only does he improve it, but he also uses it in a way that's personal. He personalizes it, and that saves him from any kind of copyright law, I think. But it also is another indication that he is an artist, that he's expressing his own personal feelings. As in the androgyny of the Milius character, and even of Cora herself, that androgyny I think should be further explored in the Ultimate Visions. Perhaps they will, perhaps they won't. We've yet We have to wait to see that. But it's that idiosyncrasy that makes Zack Snyder an artist, and that makes him interesting. It's why no logical information that you put into a computer could ever give you the brief appearance in part two of Scargiver, the very brief appearance of Excalibur. The sword from John Borman's Excalibur that Zack Snyder has previously mentioned as being an inspiration for him. It appears in the Excalibur sword appears very briefly in Scargiver. And why it's there is it's there because of the idiosyncrasies of artistic imagination. You can't get that from a computer. You can only get that from a real artist. And its meaning is yet to be explicated. So that's to wait and see. The meaning of abuse in Scargiver.
I don't know if I was that in the scene with Cary Elwes as the king going into that room with the Caesar moment, or is that was it somewhere else?
Fight between Korra and Noble.
Oh, at the end, I missed it. I got to go back and look for it, but I won't until we talk about the real version. Now, last question.
All right.
Knowing that there's going to be a part three and whatever, I assume that you're going to wait for the director's cuts of those before you watch or talk about them.
Well, once burned, twice shy. I think I'll have to wait.
All right. Well, cool.
Once burned, three times shy, rather. Twice burned, three times shy.
Yes. All right. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it for now. We will circle back in a few months to talk about Rebel Moon parts one and two, the real ones, or maybe he'll just mash it all together into 1 6-hour movie. Who the hell knows? But I, you know, hopefully we'll talk about some other films in between now and then, because this is always a fun time. And this has been a really great conversation talking sort of about movies philosophically, artistically, and not so much just digging into the nitty gritty of, you know, this happened and this happened and this performance is great and this sucked. So Armand White, I appreciate it. Aside from your piece on Scargiver, which I'll link down below, is there anything else you want to promote coming up in National Review?
You know, movie history is alive, but it's also something that we have to keep alive. So this week I wrote a piece on Oliver Stone's 1986 film Salvador, and why that should be of interest and why it is instructive to us today.
Okay. Cool. I didn't realize he made two movies in 86, because that was the same year as Platoon, right?
Right. Yes. Salvador came out early in 86. Platoon came out near the end of 86.
My goodness. All right. Well, I'll have to check that out.
And yet, of course, the best film of 86 was, in my view, was Jonathan Demme's Something Wild, not Blue Velvet.
I still have not seen Blue Velvet. Because of the oxygen mask scene. And I think I was 8 when my parents rented it on home video, said, hey, wouldn't this be cool to watch? And then they immediately sent me upstairs. So yeah, never went back to it. Much like you've never gone back to Lord of the Rings, I'm going to turn you around on this someday. I'm determined.
Good luck.
All right, Armand, thank you very much. We'll catch up with you later. I really appreciate it, man.
Okay, it's funny, and thank you.